Welcome to the Mojo Podcast. If you're new here, hello, my name is Richard Stokes, and you'll find me here every fortnight having deeply revealing and positive conversations about Mojo. Just what it is, how people have lost theirs, and how they work hard to get it back. This third series of the Mojo Podcast has a focus on people in and around sport, and the topics, issues, and learnings that have come up are both fascinating and, importantly, highly applicable to our everyday lives, whatever it is we do. This week, we're talking about how success leaves clues.
There's a phrase that I sometimes use, which is success leaves clues. So if you think back to the occasions where things have gone well for you, or occasions where you feel that you've been in harmony or in that state of living your mojo, I think then you start to explore it and you go, right, so what was happening? How was I showing up? What was going on in my behaviours? And I think eventually when you sort of reflect on that for deep enough, you start to find that there's almost like a thumbprint that's unique to you.
Some of you may recognise the Mancunian tones of Professor Damien Hughes. I was delighted he agreed to be a guest, as he's a highly demanded speaker. And true to form, this episode is littered with just incredible insights. He radiates great anecdotes and provides massive encouragement for all of us. Damien is an academic who brings his work to life for us daily in books such as The Barcelona Way. And yes, we do talk about whether FC Barcelona have lost their mojo. In his sought-after public speaking, and most recently in his superb and highly successful podcast collaboration with BT Sport presenter Jake Humphrey, the High Performance Podcast. It's one of my favourite podcasts, and we talk in depth about how they as a team work hard to produce a high quality and influential podcast. So yes, I was all ears and I was just soaking it all up. There's so much good stuff in here. We talk about values, non-negotiable behaviours, the impact of trauma on performance, coaching, and so much more. All applicable, all useful. So we'll dive straight in this week. Do make sure you play it through to the end, as Damien talks about his upbringing and who he believes to be the best coaches in sport and why. As ever, really hope you love this episode as much as I did making it, and you can show that appreciation by leaving a 5-star rating and a short review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help more people discover the Mojo Podcast. And I'd love more people to hear episodes such as this. Okay, over to my Mojo chat with Professor Damien Hughes. So, welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, and I am so excited about this episode today. We go over to Manchester in the UK, and I'm talking to Damien Hughes, Professor of Organisational Psychology and Change, international speaker, author, and co-host of the brilliant High Performance Podcast. Damien, welcome to the Mojo Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Rich. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, likewise. It's great to have you on the show. And I always start here to get a sense of what's going on for you today. So how is your mojo today out of 10?
I'd rate it as a good, healthy 8. It's a funny question. I think it's a really powerful question that you asked, Richard, because I answered that question myself about 17 years ago when I decided to do something that similar to you, of sort of leaving the corporate world and venturing out on my own. And I remember thinking, what is it I wanted in my life? And I was really strict about a couple of factors. One was that I realized after a few years in the corporate world that I used to look in my diary on a Sunday night to work out what I had going on in the week ahead. And I realized that for an awful long time, there was at least one or two occasions during the week when my stomach would lurch and I'd just dread whatever it was I had to do. And I made a promise to myself that if I was going to go out on my own, the first thing I would do is make sure that there was never anything in my day that I was dreading. There was always something that I would look forward to. And that's always been the criteria that I've applied to it. So I'm still trying to be loyal to that, which is why that I can answer quite honestly that I think it's a good, healthy 8 at the moment.
Yeah, lovely. That I said as you were saying it, the feelings came back to me, Damien, as well, because I remember that Sunday night, I just check ahead, and oh no, God, there's that call, that meeting that I'm really not looking forward to, but I've got got to do it. And then that feeling, as you say, right in the stomach. So yeah, you got very clear that you, as every time I ask that question, people are really clear, whatever the number is, it's like, this is what it is. Cause I can just feel it. And so you've slightly talked about what Mojo means to you, because you said 17 years ago, you made the choice, you wanted to do something different, live, work differently, avoid that feeling of dread. But going a bit deeper then, so what else comes up for you when you think about Mojo as a word?
I think about this idea of being your best self, like living in congruence. I sometimes refer to it as the Gandhi test. It was Mahatma Gandhi that made the comment that for harmony to happen, or for mojo in this language, your thoughts, your words, and your actions need to be aligned. So I often think about, I relate it to a phrase that you mentioned, the podcast, but a question we often ask there is non-negotiable behaviors. So when I think about Mojo, I think, are you living in congruence with your non-negotiable behaviors? So I've got three. The first one is about being kind. Being kind to myself, because I think when you do that, it gives you the capacity to be kind to others, treat others with empathy and respect and decency. The second one is about having a laugh, having fun in whatever you do. Because again, if you think back to lessons that you had at school, the lessons you enjoyed were the ones where there was humour, there was fun, there was engagement going on, which meant that you were learning so much deeper. So having fun is a non-negotiable. And then the third one is aiming to make a positive difference in every interaction. So my dad used to say to me when I was a kid, he used to say, if your presence doesn't make an impact, nobody will be bothered about your absence. And it's almost that idea of if you're going to show up and offer something, show up with something to contribute. So they're the three things. And I think if you can live in congruence with those and aim to keep them at the forefront of your mind and show up and do that, I feel that's where your mojo starts to come alive.
Brilliant. And I love that, just that depth of self-awareness that you've got there, and how you're living it. It's every day. It's not something it sounds like you're not delving into a box and go, let me just go and scrabble around for my key behaviours here. It sounds like they're there all the time for you.
Yeah, but that's come almost by trial and error in a lot of the time. It's sometimes, you know, getting put on your backside, making mistakes, having times where you lose sight of them. And I think when you, that there's a phrase that I sometimes use, which is success leaves clues. So if you think back to the occasions where things have gone well for you, or occasions where you feel that you've been in harmony or in that state of living your mojo, I think then you start to explore it and you go, right, so what was happening? How was I showing up? What was going on in my behaviours? And I think eventually when you sort of reflect on that for deep enough, you start to find that there's almost like a thumbprint that's unique to you. And then it's about almost having the courage to make sure that you do that, and that you, and equally you walk away from situations that compromise those behaviours as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, understanding that, amazing for decision making, especially as life gets more complicated, there are more demands on you, just to know this is a definite yes, this is a definite no, because it's just not
absolutely
my behaviours. Yeah,
this came to life a few years ago where I remember being offered a contract from an organisation that it was like I don't know what you'd call it, like a retention contract that they would pay you like every month. And I remember saying to them, but it was like, I didn't enjoy the work, but they were like, but it gives you security. And I was like, security isn't an important value for me.
Yeah.
And I understand why you're offering it, but it's a values clash. It's not that if I wanted security, I'd be living a different life than the one that I am. Yeah. And I think when you realize that often our clashes don't have to be personal. They don't have to be because I don't like somebody. It just means that we've got a different set of trademark behaviours that are important to us. And therefore, I think it allows you to make clear-headed decisions, because you just go, it doesn't allow me to be congruent, and you won't get the best out of me
by
bringing me into this environment on those terms.
Got it. And that, and what comes up for me there is to talk to principals. What is it? A principal isn't a principal until it's cost you some money. And that probably cost you a little bit of money at the time, but it was more of a lesson. You know, I was living my values then, and I was being true to myself.
Yeah. But again, it comes back to that you only know that through living it, you know, like that makes me sound like walking away from it. I hope it doesn't come across as arrogant, but I've done that where I have compromised and found myself not enjoying an experience. And then equally, I think because I'm not enjoying it, the person that's brought me in isn't getting value out of it either, because they're almost buying my head and not my heart as well.
Yeah.
So therefore, I think it takes a lot of reflection till eventually you go, you know what, let's be really clear about this. And that way it just removes any ambiguity from your world.
Yeah, exactly. And getting into shifting gears slightly, because I'd love to come and talk about the podcast that you and Jake do, the High Performance Podcast, straight off the bat.
Yeah.
Talking about where you are, it sounds to me, living your values and you are in flow and you are enjoying it, is when you're sitting down with these amazing athletes, entrepreneurs, creatives. You've had, you know, I think you were saying 50 odd amazing guests so far.
Yeah.
In the podcast. And just, you know, I know you're not going to bang on about this, so I'm going to bring the numbers. Over 3 million downloads so far, which is amazing. The number one sports podcast in the UK and in many other countries as well, which I think the international breadth of it is incredible too. And regularly in the top 10 of all UK podcasts. It's, you know, it's going amazingly. So what's that doing? What's that doing for you, Mojo?
Not a lot, to be honest. And I know this might sound a bit facetious, and it isn't intended to, but I often think the only thing we can do is do our best in terms of how it's received is almost outside of our control, if that makes sense. So I think if you measure your self-worth by how many downloads it gets, I think you're on pretty tricky territory there in terms of for your own self-esteem. So I'm delighted. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think those figures are incredible, and I find it quite humbling that people have given up their time to listen to it and been generous in terms of recommending it to others. But the only bit that I really focus on is, have I showed up and delivered my best? And if I do that, I think your passion, your interest, your curiosity transmits to other people. And if they find that interesting, that's great. But I don't tend to get, like, I know that's probably not commercially the best way to operate. I think you've got to be on the front foot, but there are other people that work on the podcast that is their specialism. I think from my point of view, I think I concentrate on just turning up and doing my best. And I think there's been occasions that, like, I did one the other week where I had a conversation with Jake that I felt I hadn't shown up at my best. I felt like I started a question and I fudged it halfway through, and I was furious at myself for the rest of the day. Because I think the only bit I can control is how I show up. And I felt like I fudged a question because it was quite a contentious issue that I wanted to ask about. And about halfway through, I felt that I was being insensitive to the person on the other end of it. So I ended up fudging it, and it ended up being, it didn't go anywhere. It wasn't an effective question, and we didn't get an effective answer. And I was annoyed at myself. And I was speaking to Jake about it afterwards, and he just again reminded me of one of my trademark behaviors, which is this idea of make a positive difference. Because he just said, you know what, if you're going to do it, if you're going to ask a difficult question, just go and get on the front foot and ask it. Don't try and fudge it. Don't try and be half-hearted in it. Just explain why you're asking the question, so they know that you're not trying to be salacious or trying to be unkind to them. And then just ask it, and then they can choose to respond in however they do. So I think I go through a lot of reflection in terms of doing the best I can, but that's really where my focus lies.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that's great advice to anyone thinking about doing a podcast, not gripping too hard onto numbers, but thinking about have I turned up today? Have I done my best? And that's all you can control.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and that's a great place to be. And I love just getting into... We're going to talk about teams today. We're talking broadly about sport, very broadly. But you and Jake as a team, I really reflect, and you've talked about there, that how you're you know, helping each other, cheerleading for each other. But what you both bring is, I love this balance of, obviously you've got the, I guess, the rigor in the academics, but it's what I love. It's very applied, hype, very applied to what's going on. And Jake's background as a sports journalist, I guess he's got an eye for the story, but I also see that he doesn't chase the story. He talked there about not being salacious. He's not chasing a story. He, both of you, let the flow happen in the conversation. And that can't be easy for him, I'm guessing, because of his training. Is that is that fair?
Yeah, I think, like, he's phenomenal. And I think it, like, his talent is phenomenal. Like, he's a great bloke. I really love, we were talking earlier about values, and I really love his values. And I feel that I can really identify with a lot of his stuff. And I think he genuinely wants to make a positive difference as well, which again aligns with what I've said. So I really admire him. But I think a lot of Jake's talent is almost like an invisible talent, if that makes sense. And so if I can explain, the first ever interview we did was with Ben Ainslie, and we went down to Portsmouth to the Ineos headquarters, which is where his boats are, and we were arranging to meet Ben. And I've never done a podcast before. Like, I've never hosted anything like this. So I know what I don't know, and I know that I'm out of my comfort zone. And I've spoken to Jake that and said, and he said, well, that's my job to sort of hold this together. Your job is to come along and ask the questions and sort of supplement what we're doing. So I'm sat there, and I'm going to confess, I've got butterflies in my stomach. I'm feeling a bit nervous. And then we sat on this sofa. Ben sat just opposite us. And the producer goes, right, guys, we're recording. And the best way I can describe what happened next was, have you ever been stood on a train platform and there's a train that's not stopping at the station, comes through at full speed? And in that moment, it's like the ground shakes beneath your feet and all the air gets sucked out. And that's what happened next. It was like Jake just started, and he went into this brilliantly polished, really fast-paced introduction. And it felt like the train coming through the station. And it took my breath away. And then after a couple of seconds, I thought, I need to get on board this train. So I literally just closed my eyes and jumped, thinking, I'll hold on somewhere along the way. And it was, and that was the first experience. And I don't think that's gone away so much, that I think I can really appreciate the craft of what Jake does. So he listens deeply, but then he's able to keep the flow going, the pace of it. He's generous in terms of bringing me in to make sure that there's a balance, and make sure that if he thinks I've got something to say. So there's a real talent to what he does. And I think you don't appreciate it until you're sat up close and you can almost see that invisible scaffolding that holds it all together. And I think that's a real talent that Jake has. But I think, just like I say, his values are incredibly decent, he's kind, and he wants to make a difference. And so I think when you have that sort of values match, I think that's where you can sort of disagree on something, like when I gave you the example of that question. So that to me was like a task disagreement, because the way I executed the task, I'm happy that Jake can challenge me and say to me, you could have done that better, or we can improve on this. But in terms of as a person, I think we both come from a similar place in terms of wanting to do the best we can and make a positive difference for people.
And bringing it, you know, slightly back to sport, because you are talking to a lot of sports people who, I guess, they're very, you know, sports people these days at elite levels, high performing levels, they have to be very media savvy, and there's training and there's advice, and there's probably, you know, oftentimes someone sitting at their shoulder, don't answer that, do you answer this? But yet you're both, I think, through the way you do it, through your values, are able to draw out this incredible humanity from your guests. And what have been some of your, thinking more about the sports people now, what have been some of your observation of what have you seen that's come out, what are the themes?
I mean, that's a brilliant question, Rich. I think a theme that we've not necessarily explicitly spoken about it, but I think it relates to what you've said in terms of the generosity of our sports guests, is it's built on trust. So when we started the series, what we did was Jake and myself called on people that we had a relationship with, that like people that we knew. So for example, Tracy Neville is somebody that I'd worked with for about 3 years, and I know Tracy and I really admire her. Or Ole Solskjaer is somebody else that I know. So, and Jake knows, say, Robin Van Persie or Sean Dyche or Rio Ferdinand, for example. Yeah. So they're some of the sports people that between us we knew. So what we did was we had a relationship built on trust. So when we approached them and said, we'd like to talk to you around high performance and what you've learned on the journey and the principles that other people could take away, I think we had that relationship where they knew we weren't trying to stitch them up. We weren't trying to make fools of them. We weren't looking to expose inadequacies. We were trying to understand learnings. And by definition, to learn something, you've got to have made a mistake. It's not all gone linear. So I think that's how we started the first series, by drawing on relationships where trust existed. And I think what's happened as a consequence of that is that other sports people, because we know, like, we get messages from lots of sports teams or individuals, like from dressing rooms who are using it as CPD in like Premier League clubs. And like a friend of mine with one international rugby team in the Six Nations at the moment sent me a picture from the team room on Friday night before they played, where they were listening to one of the podcasts, some excerpts. So we know that within sporting environments, it's being listened to and reflected on and learned. And I think what that's doing is people are trusting what we're trying to do with it. So I think by definition, others that then come on that maybe we don't know have got a sense of psychological safety that they're coming into that environment and we're not trying to kipper them or stitch them up. So I wouldn't underestimate in any context, but sport in particular, with, like you say, these guys are media trained not to slip up or not to make any faux pas. I think when trust exists there, I think that allows people to relax and be a little more open. I mean, another thing that we do is we offer people the chance to say to them on reflection, if there's any edits that you want to make, please feel free to do that. Because again, like Jake said it to he said it to a few of them, that we're not looking for tabloid headlines in this, that we're not going after the easy story.
Yeah.
So we've had we've had a few criticisms from people that, like, we had we did the boxer a couple of weeks ago, Carl Frampton, and when we were talking to him, there'd been a panorama program on BBC a few weeks earlier about a guy that runs a boxing promotion that has been linked to the drug trade and things like that.
Yeah.
And we got quite a lot of criticism for, like, why didn't you ask him about that? And the point is, but that's nothing to do with high performance. That wasn't what we were talking to him about, his career and the lessons he's learned of winning world titles, losing them and things like that. So we're not like a panorama documentary. We're not trying to uncover criminal links if there are any. That's, and my point was, if you know, like to some of the critics, it's like, well, you ask him then. If you're that passionate about discovering the truth, I'm sure if you contact him, he'll furnish you with an answer.
Yeah. But
from what I can understand, he's already answered it and said, and so what, he's not going to give us anything new or different on that.
Yeah. What I love about that is you and Jake are crystal clear about what the values of the podcast are. You know, your personal values, but you also know what this podcast is about and how you get the most out of it and your guest is by honouring those values. And
well, I'll give you an example. Like when we did Johnny Wilkinson.
Oh, yeah.
So Johnny came along and his very first response, the first question we always ask is, what is high performance to you? And his answer was, I can't answer that question. And we're like, whoa, okay, right, where's this going to go? And then he took us off on a journey that I was just so humbled that there's a guy here that's reached the summit of his profession. And he was like, I don't want to talk about rugby, but I'll tell you about my mental health challenges. I'll tell you about the dark places that pursuit of excellence took me to and the damage it caused. And you know, he used quite an emotive phrase where he said, I didn't enjoy my career, I endured it. And you go, wow, okay, this is really You know, he apologized for a book he wrote in 2004 because he says he believes that it caused a spike in mental health issues amongst young men. And you go, gosh, wow, this is a bloke here that's really giving you something very different.
Yeah.
And he, like, we literally sat for an hour and a half, and he was so great in sharing it. And at the end of it was only then did he say, please don't edit this to make me look a dick. Because he was conscious that you could have taken comments out of context, you could have edited it for controversy and things like that.
Yeah.
And what we did was, when we sat down after Johnny had left us, we made the decision that normally we try and edit it so it comes in certainly under an hour, but around 45 minutes to an hour. And we took the decision then, said, let's just put it out in the full hour and a half entirety. So with no edits, no changes at all. Let's just put it out so that we honour the trust that he's given us. He's just come along and given us trust without any requests. So we said, let's honour that trust by almost just taking what he's given us and sharing it with people. And then there's no misunderstandings that people could go, oh, you misinterpreted what he said. No, here's exactly what he said, and this is what we agreed to put out there. So I think stuff like that, I think, again, it goes back to the first question that we were talking about on this, Richard, that when you're clear about what you stand for, it helps your decision-making to be able to be applied with a little bit more clarity.
Yeah, absolutely. And this... all this incredible trust that you're building with guests, and I appreciate some of them were people you've known, but a lot of people are coming to you saying, I really want to be on, I want to tell my story, my real story, in an appropriate way. I guess my view is this trust is allowing you to be a real observer of behavior, because this is I guess is a lot of what you do. And I wanted to just switch gears slightly. And I wanted to talk a bit about Barcelona.
Okay,
The Barcelona Way. So I read that a couple of years ago. I heard you actually on another podcast, Bruce Daisley's Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat.
Oh, yeah.
Fabulous episode. And I was like, I remember I was listening to it and I was driving. So I've got to stop driving because I need to make notes. On this podcast, I've got to stop. Yeah. And the book is actually behind me. And no word of a lie, most pages are turned down because I'm making notes, or I've made notes, and amazing book. But I suppose the question being, how have you got so close to, you know, this Barcelona is not just a team, an organization. It's kind of like a religion. It's the region of Catalonia. But you got so close to what was going on there, and understanding, I guess, I don't know, the truth. How did you manage to do that?
Well, first of all, thank you. I really appreciate your sort of kind and generous comments on that, Reg. Again, I'd come back to that word trust. So I was conscious that I was an outsider and there was no reason for people to open up and share it with me. And there was a really nice story about it, that I was doing lots of the research from outside, but conscious that I was thinking, I need to speak to people here and verify what I'm observing and what evidence I'm getting was actually their intent. And I remember one day I was getting really frustrated because I was getting rebuffed by different people that say, no, they won't talk to you about that. They won't do this. And I went out for a run just to clear my head. And I thought, I'll go out for a jog. And I sort of came back and I literally got back to the door of my house and a name popped into my head of a guy that I'd done some work with in a Premier League team a few years earlier. So I'd done some work with this one particular team in the Premier League. And long story short, I was given a contract and circumstances changed within the club that meant that my contract, like, I could have been paid up for it, but they didn't need me. And it was evident that they didn't need me. So I went to this particular guy at this club and said, listen, let's just rip up the contract. And he was like, but we're legally obliged to do it. And I was like, listen, we're all grown ups here. Situation has changed. There's no malice. Like, the situation has changed through no fault of anybody's own. So there was a change of manager and a whole heap of different things. And I said, let's just be grown up. Let's just knock it on the head. And this guy said to me, he said, nobody does this in football. And I said, that's why I don't work in it. I tap into it. But it went back to my trademark behaviours of I wasn't going to offer value. So I said to this particular guy, I said, listen, maybe you can help me out one day. And I said, but let's just part as friends and do it that way. So I'd had this conversation about 5 years earlier, and I got back from a run and his name popped into my head. So I sent him an email very quickly. I just said, is there any way that you know this guy called Ferenc Soriano that was chief exec, he'd been the chief exec of Barcelona, he's now at Manchester City, and he just doesn't do media interviews. So is there any way you can speak to him and and just explain what I'm trying to do and ask whether you get any time? So I went upstairs for a shower, and literally I'd come back down, and in the 20 minutes or so, there was a message on my phone from the guy I'd emailed saying to him, I'm on my way to dinner with Ferenc at the moment. Right? This is how the world works. Wow. He said, I'm on my way to dinner with him this evening. Of course I'll ask him for you. So within 24 hours, I had Ferenc Soriano's PA get in touch with me to say, when do you want to meet? And that was almost like the lead domino. That when Ferenc met me, he then introduced me to Cheeky Begiristain, and then players were prepared to start speaking to me, and it happened in that way. But again, it was a neat story of something that it was like being true to your mojo 5 years earlier.
Yeah,
like there was never any intent of this might come back and help me, but it was just about just do the right thing, and I was fortunate enough that the universe conspired to help me 5 years after that.
I love that story, Damien, because of that timeline of you, again, as you said, I lived by my values. I was true to myself. I kept my mojo where it needed to be by making this decision, parting as friends. And as you say, what goes around came back around 5 years later, and you're getting these amazing intros. And hearing you say the universe, I love that as well. You know, trust. I mean, I know if that's common in your profession as an academic, but say, I trust in the universe for this is going to come back to me.
Well, I think about it, like we interviewed on the podcast Matthew McConaughey, and he was speaking in those terms, and it really sort of resonated with me that he talks about don't leave any crumbs. And it was like, what do you mean by that? And his point was, he said to me, he said, if I came over to Manchester and robbed you, I stole your wallet off you, and I had a day living off your debit card. And he went, and I know that I'm never coming back to Manchester again. He went, that's fine. He said, but somewhere in my unconscious, I'm always looking over my shoulder that one day I might bump into you. And it might happen in the most unusual circumstances, and it might cause me the most embarrassment. And he went, so don't leave any crumbs, just don't steal the credit card in the first place. Do you know what I mean? He was like, don't be a dick. You could sum it up with them. Don't be a dick in any circumstances. And that way you don't have to worry about it coming back and biting you on the backside years later. And I just think, and that's why I think what you do in terms of your executive coaching of just helping people find that mojo of answering some of these questions that we often don't get time to do. It's not that we don't have the inclination often, it's that just having the time to stop and somebody prompts us with questions like what I know you do is such a powerful way of then setting up our lives so we're not leaving any crumbs behind. We can, you know, in the moment we're in with the information we have and the tool and the resources at our disposal, we're doing the best we can. And that means that even years later, you can look back on it. And even if it doesn't work out for you, you go, I still did the best I could in that particular moment.
Yeah, love that. You got into Barcelona, obviously, had the conversations. People took you into their trust. You're able to write the book and really understand what they'd done. Now, you know, going through the book, that would be a whole podcast in itself. But I'm just interested in your observation of, you know, Barcelona as a team, you know, when you were with them and working with them, observing them then versus what you're seeing now, because this is the same team. A lot of the same, maybe some of the same players like Messi is kind of still there, but it strikes me, I'm going to use the word, it seems they've lost their mojo.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think if you go back far enough in their history, they've had periods like this in the past. So you look back in, there was in 1988, there was the famous issue, they call it in Barcelona, the mutiny of Hespederia, after the hotel where the players came out and threatened to go on strike because of a tax issue, right, that they said that the club should have paid a tax bill for them. And literally the next game after this famous declaration, they played Real Madrid at the Camp Nou, and the Barcelona fans booed their own players against their biggest rivals. And there were signs up calling their own players money grabbers. So as a response to that, what they did was they brought in Johan Cruyff, and he came back and just laid down this blueprint of culturally, these are the rules of the game, these are the behaviours of humility, hard work, team first, yeah. This is the style of football. So Cruyff came in, and they almost followed that blueprint for the next couple of decades. And then Rijkaard came in, he won them the Champions League, he was incredibly successful. And then the 2 years after that, according to different people at the club, they just said their intensity fell off. There was almost a little bit of complacency. They just thought it was going to go on, and things went badly wrong. So what they did is a response to that. They brought in Guardiola, that came back and laid down the blueprint again and just reminded them, remember, this is what makes us successful. This is how we did it. And they've had that golden era of the last decade or more following that blueprint. And I just think that it's a really interesting situation that success can often be as big a problem as failure in lots of businesses, because there's that old saying, isn't there, that success has got many fathers and failure is often born a bastard.
Yeah.
And it's that idea that nobody wants to hold the failure, but everyone wants to claim credit for the success. And I think what that can often do is it dilutes your focus on what's important, what the blueprint is. When we've been successful in the past, what is it? So I'm not close enough to say that's what's happened, but it would certainly appear that way from a distance, that they've almost lost sight of the principles that made them successful. So even little things like the debate about Messi, I think you can trace that back to a few years ago when Messi was involved in that tax case, and Barcelona came out and said, we are all Messi. And you go, well, hang on a minute. As a club, you represent the region of Catalonia to both Spain and the wider world. And this is a guy that in a court of law has been alleged to have been withholding taxes or whatever it was from the region of Catalonia. And yet the club that's supposed to be a symbol of that comes out and supports an individual over state in a court case. I just think that that then goes from being a commitment culture to being a star culture, where a few people describe it as the messiocracy. So it's almost about keeping Messi happy. And last summer, when there was the breakdown in relations and there was the huge debate whether Messi was going to leave or not, that to me was an organisation that was unhealthily reliant on one individual to stay, rather than just having the faith that our values are going to remain true and we'll find a way of being true to our values rather than responding to the whims of a couple of individuals. So my guess is that I think what will happen is they'll go through this period of turmoil that they're experiencing. And then I think you'll probably see somebody like Xavi or Iniesta come back in the capacity of a head coach, and their proper Catalans come in, lay down the blueprint in a similar manner that Guardiola did before him. Yeah. And I think you'll see them rise again. But I think it's almost like that ability. Charles Handy talks about the U curve, that you have to reinvent yourself before the curve dips back down again. And I think that's what they failed to do from the outside. But I'm confident that they've got the blueprint there. It's almost within the culture. They just need to dust it down and go back and revise it again.
Yeah, got it. And that sense of, yeah, as you said, almost when you're blessed with so much success, maybe the learning slightly stops, because a lot of our learnings can come from when we are failing, as long as we've got the right, as you said, the humility to learn from that. And that I guess that leads me to another question around a lot of the athletes, sports people you've spoken to, who seem to have gone through an amount of trauma in their life and failure, and that's somehow propelled them to a more high performing state. Is that what you've seen?
It's an interesting observation, Rich. I think that there was a paper done a few years ago by the British Olympic Association called "Does Trauma Lead to Talent?" And what they found is that an awful lot of high performers have suffered some kind of trauma, whether this is a loss of a parent, a breakdown of a relationship, whether it's some setbacks in different guises, and there does seem to be a high proportion of subsequent high performers have gone through that. I think it's important to point out that I don't think that trauma leads to talent. I think trauma, then reflection, can sometimes lead to better performance. Right. And I think because of, you know, I don't want to be crass, that there's lots of people that have suffered trauma that haven't gone on to perform high that are still living that trauma or the difficulties of it. Yeah. I think it's the reflection piece at the tail end of it, where you sit back and you go, well, what did I learn? What was the lessons that this applied? What can I do differently next time? I think that reflection piece is where the real gold comes from. So I think all, like in the podcast, when we've interviewed like Kelly Holmes, for example, where she spoke about her whole background was what you or I might describe as difficult. You know, she in her own words, she said, her mum was only 17 when she had her. Her father was never on the scene. She was a mixed race girl in a predominantly white environment. She wasn't particularly gifted at school. She was in and out of care homes, being cared for by different people when her mother and her grandparents couldn't look after her. And she was somebody that then subsequently went on to self-harm. And she spoke in like real moving detail about some of this stuff. That you'd have to have a heart of stone not to like be moved by it. But I think the key point was that she wasn't just experiencing this. She was then learning lessons about herself and what it taught her about. She told us that because she'd survived that trauma, she did a reflection on, well, what qualities do I have? And one of the things was, I've got resilience. I'm a survivor. I can survive the worst things that many people can imagine and come out of it intact. Mm. And then that reflection gave her the strength to persevere even when her body was breaking down in elite athletic environments. She was able to draw on the trauma of her childhood to see the qualities that had been tested that she could still apply. So it's a long answer to a really powerful question that you've asked. And I think it's that idea of trauma can lead to talent as long as there's a sufficient amount of reflection that goes on in between those stages.
Yeah, and again, what an amazing observation from what you've seen, experienced, and the people you've spoken to, that period of reflection. And what, you know, we talked about Kelly Holmes and how she did it, but on the whole, have people been able to self-reflect, or have they got some help from, well, it could be psychologists, it could be, I wanted to sort of move on to the role of coaches as well. Do some coaches do a good job of this, of helping people reflect? I'm not necessarily on deep trauma, but on performance, because, when your performance is dipping, you're still a great athlete. It's got to be a self-belief thing.
Yeah, definitely. Again, I think it's a brilliant question that you're asking. I think everybody that we've spoken to that has gone on to high performance has had people around them to help them, to advise them, to nurture them, whether that's a coach, whether that's somebody within their inner circle that's prepared to be seemingly honest with them. I don't think that high performance can happen without the role of a coach or an advisor or a mentor around you. I've yet to see anybody that has done it in that singular way. So you definitely need somebody around that. I mean, I know that you work as an executive coach, and I know that's the value that you offer. And anyone listening to this, I would never underestimate the power of somebody that can come in and just coach and be a sounding board and ask you some really powerful questions. And to go on to the second part of your question, that's what the best coaches do. The best coaches, in my experience, there was a great answer I got to this many years ago, that when I wrote my first book, I went out to Miami and interviewed a guy called Angelo Dundee. Now, Angelo Dundee was Muhammad Ali's trainer and Sugar Ray Leonard's trainer. And he was regarded as like just almost like the doyen of boxing coaches. And I was like a kid in a sweet shop, because that's my background. I grew up in boxing.
Yeah.
And I was like a kid in a sweet shop with Angelo, and I was asking him, like, oh, what was it like working with that fighter? And what did that fighter do in that situation? And he was brilliant, and he indulged me for about an hour, really, really sort of really sweetly. And after about an hour, he went, "Damien," he said, "I think you're misunderstanding what I do." And I was like, "Oh, why? What? What have I misunderstood, Angelo?" And he went, "I don't work with fighters." He said, "I happen to work with young men that fight for a living." And in that one sentence, wow, he summed up what I think was the power of what great coaches do. They don't teach a sport; they teach people that just happen to play that sport. You know, just like you're an executive coach, you don't work with executives, you work with people that just work in executive positions. And I think the best coaches see the human being far before the job.
That is, and yeah, what's so powerful. And that just what's coming to mind for me is I'm, you know, quite early on in this series talking to sports people, but all of them have just talked about wanting to be seen as a human being, as a person, and that's when they're at their best. When, and I think this can be, you know, the sporting public when we're watching from afar, and sometimes people are tweeting really hideous things as well about people going out doing their job. But we see them as something different. We you know, as soon as they put on the uniform, the shirt, they become this thing, the athlete, and they're not the person. But they remain. They always have been the human being. And I say that's the great thing that coaches, the best coaches, get that.
Yeah, definitely. I do a test sometimes with I tend to do it with young coaches, but it came from an experience years ago where I was working with a head coach of a particular team, and he described one of his players as a dickhead to me. Right? He said he's a dickhead. And my question was, is he a dickhead or is he just a dickhead for you? And he went, "What do you mean?" And I was like, "Well, it's a genuine question. Do you think he genuinely displays dickhead tendencies in every aspect of his life? Because he might do, I don't know. Or do you think he just behaves like a dickhead when he's around you?" And the coach was like, "I don't know. How would I know?" And then we came up with what I call the dickhead test, right? Although in certain company, I might make it apply to response. But just ask him a series of questions. I went, "What's the name of his partner? What's the name of his kids? How old are they? How are they getting on at school? Where's he going on his holiday when the season finishes? How's the health of his parents?" And it was all questions that were all around just a human being. Mm. And the coach was working with me, went, "I don't know." And he knew at a very shallow level a couple of the answers, but beyond anything else. And I went, "Maybe he's just a dickhead for you then. Because there's no value in the relationship. You've not given him any value as a person. So he doesn't value investing in this relationship." And it's a test that sometimes applied, mainly to young coaches, that say, just get to know them as people before you try to then coach them and give them value out there on the training field.
Yeah, yeah. And what a great lesson that is. Because I guess when you're starting out as a young sports coach, you're gripping on so tight to the result, to the performance, that you maybe don't have that trust to sort of let go and get, if I get to know the person, understand the person, coach the person, I'm going to get a much better performance out of them. And I guess that's some maturity in that. And so from a coaching point of view, you've worked with loads. Who's the best? Who's the best you've worked?
That's a difficult one because there's so many of them that are brilliant. And often, like, if I can explain a bit about my background, because I'll answer the question, but
yes,
I'll give
please,
you a bit.
Yeah.
But without giving you context, it appears like I'm biased, right? So long before I was born, my dad had set up a boxing gym in Manchester. And people listening to this, their sort of perceptions of boxing gyms might be they're in sort of like gritty, urban, inner city areas. Mm. And that was certainly the case of where I grew up and where the boxing gym was. But my dad had set it up in the 1960s. And he had a dream that his own story was fascinating, that he was an illegitimate child in Catholic post-war Manchester. So he'd grown up without a father, and his sport was boxing. And boxing is one of those that if you've not got somebody in your corner looking out for you, you can get badly hurt, and that happened to him. Right. So I think boxing was always a way of being a father figure that he'd never had and making sure that nobody ever got hurt. And that was two of his big drivers to set up the gym. So by the time I arrived, and my brothers and my sister, the gym was sort of in full flow, and that became our playground. That was where we were growing up. So from a very, as far back as I can remember, I was around two things that were unconsciously going on. I was around high performance. So I was around guys that were going on to Olympic Games and coming back with medals. I was around guys that were becoming world boxing champions. But I was also around a really powerful culture, because the environment, there was about 20 years ago, there was a study done that the area where we grew up was categorized as like Europe's third poorest district. And that gives you an idea of like the kind of social issues. Wow. But this particular gym was almost like an enclave of decency and respect and courtesy and all of those things where people could go and feel valued, where maybe they wouldn't feel valued outside of there. So when I went down the sort of academic route, there's a phrase that resonated with me where we talk about, you don't do research, we do me search, where we often try and make sense of our own lives and biographies.
Right.
And I think those two things shaped the career that I do now, because it's very much around how can you use culture to deliver high performance and how that happens. And I would credit a lot of it back to that environment where I grew up in. And it was all the work that was done in the shadows, the work that you would never see, that if you think of it like the iceberg analogy, most people only see the tip of the iceberg, but the stuff that goes on underneath is where the real value lies. Mm. And that really makes me passionate. So when you say, who's the best coach I've ever worked with? I love the guys in the shadows, the guys that you probably have never heard of, that are out there just doing the right thing day after day without anybody necessarily knowing what they're doing, but they're creating cultures where high performance can then take place. So I'd answer the biased answer of my dad, because he was obviously my first mentor, but I got to see growing up the hard work, the sacrifice, the effort and the discipline that went into high performance. And when I categorize high performance, I'm not talking about people having to win world titles or Olympic medals. I'm talking about people just making making a difference in somebody's life. So I'll give you there was a nice ending to this, that a couple of years ago, Manchester Council named a road after my dad in honour of the work he's done in that community. And my dad's quite poorly now. He's got advanced dementia.
Right.
But there was about 300 people came along. It was a really bitterly cold January day when the Lord Mayor of Manchester came and unveiled this road in honour of him. And I would estimate, Richard, it was about 80% of the people that showed up that day to pay tribute had never set foot in a boxing ring in their life, but they'd been members of that community, that culture. And what they all wanted to come along was speak about the impact that that culture had had on them as people, as parents, as partners, and in other professions of their life. So that's how I categorize high performance. It's not about the medals, trophies, or the stuff that happens in the spotlight. It's the great coaching is happening in the shadows to build cultures.
Amazing. So yeah, it's I love that, the shadows, the work that's just going on all the time in the background. And that's why it's what gets your mojo where it needs to be. It's making a positive difference, because it's just constantly there. And thank you for going back as well and just explaining a bit about your background, where you come from.
Sure.
Because I guess it explains a lot of what you've done since. And then, and it's just to sort of tie us up, looking forward again.
Yeah.
Thinking about what's coming up for you. Obviously, the podcast is it third series now?
We're in the fourth series now. We've recorded a lot of series five already. So we're pretty busy with that at the moment.
So some amazing guests, I dare say, to look forward to. And what else? You mentioned there's a book in the offing as well.
Yeah, so it's not officially been announced yet, but we've been writing a book based on the lessons from the High Performance Podcast and our guests trying to distill some of their lessons and make them practical for people. So we're in the process of writing that. We're in hopefully the closing stages of doing it, but that comes out towards the end of the, it's scheduled to come out towards the end of this year.
Amazing. Well, I'll look out for that. And just you have your closing question around non-negotiables, Damien, which I love. My closing question is a little bit different. Well, actually, no, hang on. I'll rewind slightly. It is about non-negotiables because it's about your personal non-negotiables. What are the three things that you need to do every day so your mojo is as high as it can be?
I'd go back to the answer that I gave you at the start. So being kind to myself is really important. I think I've made this mistake in the past that I think I've sort of pushed myself beyond my limits and then suffered the consequences of it. And I think when I trace it back, I think pushing myself beyond the limits is often correlated with not being particularly kind to myself. So I might have been exhausted at something, and that inner voice is saying to myself, just man up, get on with it, stop whinging. And it's pushed me beyond my capabilities where, you know, I've ended up longer than 10 years ago. I ended up contracting meningitis. The reason I got it was I'd basically pushed myself to such a limit that my immune system was depleted and I was going to get an illness. I just happened to look out on meningitis. And I remember thinking to myself, I've got two young children now, but I remember thinking, how would I feel if somebody spoke to my children in the way that I speak to myself? And I thought, and it really upset me. I thought, bloody hell, I'd be horrified. And that's where that sense of being kind to myself comes from. So have to be kind. And that's where the just being understanding, just sort of doing something that's for me is really important. Doing something that, looking in that diary and making sure that there's something in my day that is going to excite me and make me laugh. is another one.
Yeah.
And then just go back to that positive difference, just do something that, whether it's a simple act of kindness, whether it's a reaching out to somebody just to send them a message, whether it's just doing it with my son and my daughter, just trying to do something that makes a positive impact on them that day, just telling them that I'm proud of them, that I love them, just trying to water the roots of their self-esteem. Just stuff like that, anything that you feel can make a positive difference. They're the three things that are non-negotiable for me.
Love it. And I just want to say, you've been kind and made a positive difference to me, and I've had a lot of fun by you coming on the podcast today, Damien. I really, really appreciate
it. Oh, that's a great validation then. Thank you.
Oh, completely. you can call it quits today. You've done.
I'll pack up now. I'll be a right bastard now.
But David, thank you so much for joining the Mojo podcast. I mean, for me, just so much in this profound, powerful, illuminating and honest conversation. And I loved it. Thank you so much for joining.
Oh, no. Well, thank you. I really admire what you're trying to do, Richard. I love your story. I love the courage that you've shown, and I love your podcast. So thank you for having me on. It's an honor.
Can you tell just how much I loved that conversation? He's something of a legend for me, Damien, even before I met him. But what a lovely guy. And to meet someone with that amazing balance of very high IQ and EQ is such a rare thing. Now, if you haven't got into the High Performance podcast yet, I highly recommend it. The Johnny Wilkinson episode will blow your mind. And as Damien mentioned, the book of the podcast is coming out in December, at the end of this year, and I'm pre-ordering as we speak. So much in here, as I promised you. So I'm going to go back to the theme of the episode as my main takeout, and indeed maybe an action for all of you, and just remembering that success leaves clues. So make sure you notice your successes. Take time to celebrate them, the big and small. Notice what was going on. Who was with you? Why were you showing up as the best version of yourself that particular day? Get feedback from people who witnessed the success. Write it down, keep it somewhere, and go to it when you're in need of a little bit of positive reinforcement, which frankly, we all do from time to time. Okay, there are more details in the show notes about Damien and how to find out more, and links to his podcast, for example. The Mojo podcast will be back in 2 weeks' time with more revealing stories and inspiring content. So do hit that subscribe button to get a notification of the new episodes, and please do take a little time to leave a 5-star rating and give me some clues of my maybe success, and write a short review, please, on Apple Podcasts. As I say, it really helps more people discover the Mojo podcast. Okay, until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.